So we are welcoming everybody to the next podcast, and our guest today is Nadia Tsarunian and Andrei Georgescu. And we're going to talk a bit more about a new project, or it's not so new project, but the project Courizom that you're both working on, and we would like to learn more about it. But maybe we start with you guys, and you both tell us a bit on who you are and what you did so far, and what, you know, made you, as a second question, come up with the idea of Courizom. Andrei, do you want to start?
Okay. Well, thank you for inviting us to talk about this. So my history started about 9 years ago, working with traditional artisans. And I started working with Roma artisans from Romania. And it was kind of a project which had the idea to both create livelihoods in Roma communities around Romania, but also to somehow fight against some of the prejudice that was directed towards the Roma minority. And so the whole idea was to emphasize the techniques and skills, and in a very nice way, and bring to the general public some of both the traditional products, but also, you know, what could become of these traditional techniques in today's world.
And your professional background is in economics and business, right? That was the starting point, actually.
Yeah. So marketing actually is my specialty, but of course I went to business and economics school in Bucharest for me.
All right, and Nadia, you're the creative force behind Courizom, and you look back on an extensive career in design. What was kind of like your big stepstones to come all the way to Courizom in a nutshell?
Working for really global enterprises where the creation of product, or then what I call the materialization of product, is so far removed, because it's such an enormous chain of responsibilities. It becomes a very abstract concept. And then the longer I work in these places, the more I miss the real interaction with the moment when the product becomes real. And so getting closer, being asked to join Andre in a non-profit organization that helps artisans to access markets, and then to be really involved in the realization of product, was something that was so magical that I really got addicted to that moment.
So how did you both meet? How was the first encounter, and how did you get together? How was that? Do you remember the first moment when you met?
I remember the first moment, and I think poor Andre was slightly exasperated. He felt like, oh my God, another international consultant who will tell me how to run my business, my enterprise. But I think I was pretty disarming, right? Quite practical, and I don't know. Tell me. Yeah. I mean, like,
from my perspective, it was, so we had applied to the Erste Foundation for a development grant, and this had happened before I took over this idea at this small enterprise. And so 1 year later, I think, when it was finally approved, I was just informed that there's this women coming from Austria to meet me and MBQ, and that was it. You know, I was just told by a former colleague that I need to go to this coffee place and I will meet them. So I didn't know Nadia, I didn't know Alina, who was also with you, and there was another designer, and of course I didn't have any expectations, but as you say, you know, usually when somebody comes, they just want to tell you how to do things. And at that time we were desperately trying to reposition this work that we were doing with artisans and really bring them on today's market. I mean, to really compete with retail products, you know, not with traditional items. So yeah, I think in the first talk already, I was telling Nadia about those, all these workshops across Romania where we are active, and she said, oh, would it be okay if I come next week and we can drive around and I just see all of them? And I thought, wow, you know, of course. I mean, this is great, you know, because usually you would see them again in 1 year or something, you know. That was the usual approach, yeah, of your classical donor.
Right. Well, traveling around. Let's talk a bit about the MBQ project, because it's such a wonderful story in the end, and it was actually the motivation to make it larger. That's Corizom. So this is, I think, has the moment of like speaking about MBQ, because it started with an initiative of yourself, André, with working with a Roma community, and then you being brought in through the donor, but then like your very specific approach of how you do things, that it's not a touch base and then you're gone again and coming back a year later, but it's like getting really involved. And what happened next? What was...
I mean, I think what was so different is that for me at least, it's like I'm a designer, so I'm not used to levels of poverty, levels of prejudice, level of I mean, like, I'm not used to this situation. And I think once you take it out of this abstract idea of coming somewhere and doing something, but you meet the people, you have conversations with these people, you suddenly understand, I understood that what is required is a type of continuity and like engagement that will be longer and more meaningful than this like one moment intervention. And I think that was in the end the only difference that I brought to this project, is like consistently coming back, staying there and becoming a familiar person to many of the artisans, and with some of the artisans we have relationship still ongoing, you know, like, so I think that's, I mean, like, I think I have a few talents. And, but it's not even talent related, it's more like personality, that if you start something, that you just keep going at it. I think that's...
What I would add, I think, what I thought was the most important was that, so we had tried previously, and also during and after, we have worked with different designs. And many times, it was the approach of the designer was all about how the product can make them better as a designer, you know, or just showcase their talents as well as they could imagine. So it was not necessarily about the product or about the artisan. So with Nadia, when she came, we could also really talk about the market and what do we build with each individual group so that they have a chance in the market. So it was really a very thorough approach, and this is why it was very successful in the end. So, I mean, there are a few, of course not all were successful, but there were a few of the collections which were so successful that you still have the artisans producing them today, 4 or 5 years later, with small changes, or they were updated at some point, but I mean, it completely changed what they were producing. You know, they've been doing something for generations, the same product more or less, and then Nadia managed to create a new product line, which now we probably go for generations. And really, we have, I mean, Victor is one of them, and also the silversmiths. She basically changed the silversmith small-scale industry in Bucharest, because now everybody's copying this one silversmith that Nadia was working with for 2 years and developing these collections. You know, you really can see this. I mean, it's very obvious, and it's a long-term result. And it was because it was not just advice or let's make this crazy product to draw attention. It was really, okay, let's see what we can produce so that it sells. It makes everybody look good, but also people want to buy it, and so actually really do improve livelihood. It's not just about making a boom, you know, like.
Fabulous. Because that's another part, that creating the product and changing like the whole tradition and history of a whole region, I can say, or like the whole, yeah, that was really interesting, but also linking it to the real economy, right? That was also like a big part of it, that you actually found the distributor, or you found the selling points, or the big stores, or the big platforms that were really interested in the product, with the story, of course, but they would have bought the product anyways, right? And that was also a big
important. It's a huge responsibility, because it's not about self-realization. It's not about what I would like to have as a piece of jewelry necessarily, but one really needs to understand the consequences that are attached to that, and that's people's lives, right? So if you start to know these people personally, you know their children, you know their grandchildren, you know their aspirations, you know their failures. The silversmith we were talking about, and that's throughout our shared history, we meet all these artisans in remote places that are unable to survive with the knowledge that has been transferred to them for generations, because times have changed so dramatically, and there's no more market for the things that they traditionally know how to produce. So it needs a light touch intervention to make these pieces relevant for buyers that exist. I mean, like, people want authentic product, and there's a real thirst for the stories behind that product. But at some moment, and I don't quite know when that exactly happened, but the needs of the consumer and the pieces that traditionally were produced didn't meet anymore. They became like souvenirs, and we always have this conversation about souvenirs. Souvenirs are like products that I deny a right to exist. You know, they're afterthought. It's for a fictitious client who buys it as a piece of memory, but it's never about the piece. The artisan doesn't really pay any attention, because it needs to be small and inexpensive, and it's for somebody who really also doesn't really want this product. He wants a memory. So artisans in the regions that we were working with were really pushed into this like market segment of meaningless product and inconsequential product, and the more they produce this inconsequential product, the less they could survive from what they were doing. So, like, really to look again at this skill set and slightly, like, really slightly change it. That was the challenge. And also, one last thing, I think we need to remember that most artisans are really traditional people. You know, like, the reason why certain things exist over many, many generations is because the adjustments are minute and gradual. So it's, they are conservative, you know, like, there's like very rarely do you meet artisans who have a real sense of adventure or drive or ambition. It's just against the nature of their own craft. You know, so really you need to be careful with your intervention, I think, and always take them with you, because otherwise you lose them on the way.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the Corizon, because the Amber Q was kind of like the Blaupause. It was kind of like the first prototype of project that was over many years as well, because it was also a project that went on for five years, so it was quite a long process. And then you came up with a new idea, which is enlarging the whole process of the experiences that you made with the MBQ. And this is, in a nutshell, basically Corizon. Mm-hmm. So help us understand on what's the enlargement of MBQ to Corizon. What changed? What's the ambition with Corizon in order to become such a successful story as MBQ was?
So the real story is actually Andra's success story. And so a
surprise.
Group of artisans out of the MBQ pool became suppliers for IKEA. And that was, for us, an incredible moment, because that just meant that we could pull back, and the artisans would be on a platform that would just secure livelihoods on a scale that we never would be able to to guarantee, you know, because it's just like, I mean, with all these design fairs and all this like a shop in Bucharest and all these like different activities that we had, but it's still like on a smaller scale, it is just like not relevant for big communities. Yeah. And so we were looking at this success story and then also a little bit my own history, like being brought in as a new creative director into an ailing brand. And I realized that we applied the same rules to this group of artisans that I had applied for like really big companies, you know? And so that came, and then we developed this idea that we could actually develop super simplified tools working with groups of artisans and make through the development of the tools them get ready to communicate with like international buyers, not necessarily on the scale of IKEA, but like smaller, medium-sized enterprises, or ideally somebody of that scale. And we then also decided that we wanted to test this with a very diverse group of artisans. So we have women's cooperative, we have volunteers, we have crazy artists, we have religious differences, we have different crafts, we have different groupings. And so we are really trying to test on a universal scale, global scale, if our theory is true. And we found an unbelievably generous sponsor, which is a funder, which is the Erste Foundation, who allows us to verify this theory over the next 3 years.
André, you're working in different communities now, so the diversity of the communities and the people you're working with was a big part of it, so you get like the greatest variety of options, so pretty much that you can put this roadmap on everybody else's desk and it would work. In which communities are you present with Corizom? In which countries are you working in? What are they doing?
So at the moment we are active already in 6 countries, and we will be adding another 2 very soon. So we are in Romania, we are doing textiles, embroidery mainly, but not just. And then in Georgia, we are doing wood carving, in Albania, killings. These were the first 3 groups that we started with almost a year ago, and that we showed also were kind of a work in progress at the Vienna Design Week last year. And now this year we started already in Uzbekistan with ceramics, in Bosnia with copper and metal turning, and in Hungary it's this soft weaving of I think it's called
cattail.
Yeah, exactly. And we are thinking of doing a small cooperation here in Vienna, and we are looking at an African country that we would add in this spring. So the idea is to really have a very wide geographic spread, but also a very wide craft spread, and also. So in every country, basically, we have a 2-person team, one on the business side, one on the creative side, that is applying and testing this roadmap that we have developed. And we try also to make the teams as diverse as possible. So in the first countries, me and Nadia are kind of, testing and building at the same time the roadmap, and then we hand it over to other teams which are testing it in the next countries which have started this year.
So fill us in on the theory that you have. What's needed to make a community of artisans in the outskirts of the world a functional micro company, social business of different scales? What's the ingredients that we need to have the chance to become something successful?
I think it's a very, these are very familiar steps in that you use generally in the industry. It's like prototyping, for example. It's like quality control. I mean, like, these are things that are very well established processes in industry, but they have not been applied to artisans yet. It's mainly like a resource function, you know, like, so as they mostly, or the artisans that we are working with are mostly producing for fictitious clients, you know, they first produce a piece and then wait for it to sell. It's never demand driven, you know, so there's like, how do you create something that needs to have a specific size, for example, and how do you recreate something that you have done already that should look the same the second time around you do it? So it's like very basic steps on the one hand. So that's one part. And then prototyping, for example, you do it one time, there's a slight mistake, you do it again. You know, the luxury of product to recognize that something is faulty and you do it again until you get it right. You know, for example, in this IKEA corporation that Andre had, they had 120 prototypes, I think, until they came up with a proper product that could be produced on a large scale. I mean, no artisan in the world would be able to afford that many steps. And so, of course, we don't want to exaggerate that, but like have like three prototypes, final prototypes, start quality control, like start like stock management, for example. And like that's one thing. And then the second part of it is like visibility. So make people aware of what the potential is of this certain artisan group and show them, make it known, you know, besides the immediate community that they are surrounded.
How can we imagine the work that you do? Is it like workshops? You travel a lot to the communities and to the artisans, and then you're following the process of, for example, going through the prototype phase. And then next chapter is the quality guarantee phase. And then next chapter is the kind of like marketing issues on how it gets known. Is that how it works? Is this how you do it by the book?
What we actually do is we do three collections with each community, and they are more or less, I always say the collections are more or less an afterthought. It's not really about these collections. It's about a process where you have shared competence. You have the artisan who has the competence of making this thing, and then we have, like, this is our tool of communication. Like, and we show them, like, we do something, we test if the artisan can read a technical drawing, and then the second time, you know, like, it's like a gradual approach of something that is like a process. I always had this phrase, it's like creating a product is not a miracle, it's a process. And I really believe that that's what this is about. So, like, we go through with the artisans through this process three times, and we identify the loopholes or the bottlenecks, and then really proactively then with the community work on these like moments of critical moments. And we also believe that if you really, it's like something like muscle memory, if you repeat things, suddenly they become like automatic, you know, like then you do something. I mean, we have photographs of somebody doing it the first time, the second, and the third time, and then even the artisan is surprised about the outcome at the third time because he realizes the departure that has taken place in that process. That I think that's really interesting.
And Andre, from the business perspective, what is the steps that need to be done and clarified? What's that part?
Well, what I would like to say is that it's very surprising, or it was very surprising to me that most artisans that I've worked with so far don't really have a complete understanding of what is the cost of one of their products. Not the price, but the cost. And so this can lead, of course, to, you know, selling a mix of products where some are actually creating some income for you, but others are making you lose time or money. So of course, it's very important to really look at the process, just take a step back and look at the process from the outside, which is something that most artisans don't have the luxury to do, you know, to really take this time and look at their process. So I think this is very important. And then the second thing is that we are also giving them the opportunity to go through a process which they would normally go through with a client, but go through it and learn. You know, if you have a big company, or even if you have a smaller one, if you just get a big order, many times what happens is that you fail to deliver the first time, and then nobody has patience to try again. So what we are trying to do is to really give them this chance of going at least once or even twice through building a collection like they would do it for a client and learn from it. You know, it's okay if they fail. It's all about learning. So the first time, for example, we don't approach so much the subject of cost, the final cost from the beginning when we design it. It's just the idea that they understand the process of creating a product. And then already with the second collection, they need to start understanding what it means from a perspective of cost and really look at each individual step and process. And this also helps them to identify where they should invest more resources, being financial or human resources. You know, many times you think you need some kind of machine or you need some kind of materials, and then in reality, if you just measure everything, you realize that it wasn't there. You know, it was not what you really thought it would be. So I can just give you a very recent and simple example with the ceramics, because you know, after just looking at the process of how this one person in Uzbekistan is building just a little cup, he realized, and of course we realized as well, that it takes more time to mold, to create the clay. It just takes more time to create the clay than it takes to actually make the cup for him, because of the process that he has. So then it looks like it's much more important actually to hire somebody to make the clay than to hire somebody to make the cup, which was his initial idea. So it's just this kind of, and of course it's much easier to make the clay. I mean, once you teach somebody.
Less skilled
than to shape a cup. But of course, if you've never really counted how many minutes and how, you know, of course you can't just suddenly realize that. So it's a process, as Nadia says.
I mean, it sounds very much like every business should actually know, you know, what our costs and how much time. I mean, it's not only for the artisans business, it's basically for every other business. And we all know so many people in like a smaller scale enterprises, you know, where you would wonder, you know, to evaluate. And actually, Kugizom should be so adaptable that it's, of course, meant for artisans and creating a product and going into the process of selling something. But at the end of the day, that would actually apply to a much larger
group,
kind of like combining the design, I won't say design think, but design process with like the development of a business, and like everything seems super logic to you guys because you have went through that. But for somebody who's starting a business in different, you know, parts of the world and in different areas as well as a content wise, it might not be, you know, the combination. You can't study business or have an education as a designer every time that you would like to start something, you know. So it sounds like evaluating, finding your clients, finding out what the costs are. So how is it going in the second generation of second year? Was that successful, your first year of kind of like identifying the steps and the, you said, the bottlenecks of like difficulties of giving it, handing it over to the next teams of designers and business people? What are their experiences?
I think for just going back to us before we came in, for us it's really hard because we have worked together for such a long time. Certain things we do blindly, or we don't do them at all, but pretend we've done them, right? So, you know, and then you try to track what you're doing and make it easily digestible, because the one thing that's really important to us, we don't want to recreate the encyclopedia of how Andrea and Nadia are doing it, you know? So it needs to be really simple. It needs to give enough space for other people to be inspired to try, but then also like give like a broad type of vision where it should end, you know? Like, I mean, like it's more or less that, and then we just point out the cracking points, you know? And so we don't quite know yet how it's going, because the first visits have only started, and we are really excited because we somehow managed to get like Misha Draxler, for example, or Shilma Seh, or Marta Giardini, who has built up Sarah Home. I mean, we got really incredible people who are willing to engage on this second level of engagement, and we will need to see how it is for them, because they come with very, very different experiences, pre-existing experiences and different ambitions, and how will they fare in that process. And I think it's exciting for us to see that, because we've gained so much more competence, you know, like we've never operated in mass market like Marta has, or we have never been so driven as Jean, who has such incredible experience in like online marketing, and like we have gotten so much additional marketing into the core team. And so for me, the second year is like the big breaking point where we will need to really challenge ourselves with what we think we know, and like absorb all this knowledge into the what we believe is the perfect path, you know. And so it's a bit anarchic in a way, and we sometimes get scared, like how will this all be? But I think it's important that you have, if you say you want to do something that's universally applicable, you need to have all these different types of people bringing in this information. Because it's not a methodology that we develop for ourselves forevermore. It needs to be, it will become an open source tool. It will be available for everyone. So
it's one of the kind of like the cracking points as well, to get kind of like the individuals again back out of the project, because you are, you know, both professionals in your field. The new teams that are in the second generation, second years, are professionals in the field. Mm-hmm. So if you take that expertise away, it's being afraid that there's nothing left, basically, that the theory is not something really that abstract, that it's so applicable for everybody, but that it actually does take individual with very specific skills, experiences, as you said, doing things automatically, because you bring so much experience with.
I mean, it might happen. We really on purpose put also very inexperienced people in teams. So to see how that will turn out. I mean, like we did this on purpose, and it's not because we want one project to fail, but like how does this work when somebody is not a professional social business developer? How does it work if somebody is a well-intended, well-meaning, idealistic designer but doesn't have the experience? How will that be? So that's the thing on the one hand, but then I think that's also why we call it the Corazon toolkit, or the roadmap, or the recipe, or methodology. Like in the end, we're describing a process that is, and the process should take root, you know, no matter how talented the creative person is that is involved, how visionary the social business developer is, you know, because in the end, it's like, of course, in the end, every project will be only as good as the components are, but there's like, it should be a pathway towards success, right?
Yeah, and also the profile, more or less, of people that should be engaged in this process.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back to the beginning and go towards the end, Krishna says, looking at the MBQ, because the MBQ still exists and you're not interfering anymore, and it became its own business. And it's not only because they're selling through IKEA, but because you actually initiated a process that actually allows them to reproduce new products. Is that correct? Or is it more like that new souvenirs with more purpose are produced? No. Mean, when I put it like this. No, if you take the analyzing of the MBQ project, if you look at it with a distance on it now, are you optimistic that this is actually already working? Because this is still kind of like the core first experience project.
Working, it works very differently than I had imagined, you know, like, and that's also like learning to let go. I think I needed to be the mother of several teenagers to get to that point in my life, you know, but I was not able to let go for a long time on many of the projects I was involved with, including my children. But I also think one needs to understand that MBQ was also an activism tool, and I think there we have fully succeeded in the Romanian context. Yeah. As a livelihood project, we have only partially succeeded, and that's sad to see.
Yeah. What's the livelihood project, or what do you mean?
I mean, like people really properly can live off that on a vast scale. That has not materialized as it was intended. In our defense was that it was mostly seen as an activism tool. Do you know that it was a project that had many lives and faces, and probably if it would have from the beginning been set up as a livelihood project, we would have done it differently.
And Kuvisom is more in the livelihood project
totally
side?
Totally livelihood. Yes. It's not activism at all.
It both comes along, I think, right? It's like it's changing the communities, it's changing life. But if we go back to the metaphor of the children, maybe they're in their early 20s now. So it's not yet been decided it's all going to be a career and famous, but they are doing okay. They speak and walk. Thank you, guys. I think we leave it there. We're very excited on what's happening next. But thank you for the insight and the overview. And we'll follow the next steps and be with you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.